So now we're going to listen to Pierre-Marie Yedo, from the Pasteur Institute. Pierre-Marie is a pioneer in the field, I must say.
We are all pioneers.
You always worked on this here, right? Since I've met you, it's a long time ago. And he's been unique in trying to link the physiology and the environment to the regulation of neurogenesis, which I think we shall hear more about today, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, Pierre-Marie.
Well, thank you very much, Alain, for making this program so wonderful, so very appealing for these 2 days. But maybe I have a question for Fiona, actually. I was wondering why you have not been seeing any markers of inflammation when you have been looking for factors coming from the plexus and the... They are, okay. So I was wondering whether you have been hiding something and just you didn't want to share with us. Okay. Because, morphogenic factors and things like that, trophic factors. So, okay, good. Because this will be the end of my talk, so I didn't want to hurt what you have been telling us. Okay. As Alain have said, now we're going to change the gear and we're going to talk about... the events downstream of what Fiona have shown us today. And those downstream events will be mostly presented regarding olfaction. Why bothering producing thousands of neurons per day in a rodent? After all, it could be a waste. All these cells are going to die, or are they bringing unique features that the pre-existing neurons are not able to fulfill? And actually, I will show you that the second hypothesis might turn to be true. And later on, I will use the other place where there is an ongoing production and recruitment of newborn neurons in other circuits, which is the Dante gyruses. And I will use this model to investigate the functional meaning of this adult neurogenesis regarding mood control and factors that are regulating this production of newborn neurons. And I leave you this with the last part of my presentation. It's going to be a mixture between published results, submitted and just accepted a week ago, and ongoing works. And so I'm looking forward to get you feedback on our hypotheses, which are related to the ongoing works. Okay, so I'd like to talk about this top-down input into the adult neurogenesis. After all, Fiona has shown us that there are many places where you can regulate the production of newborn neurons, but what really will be important for the adult brain will be to adjust, to tune the survival, the fate of these newborn neurons, and the targets. Is there any way to regulate the partners of adult neurons, for instance, according to the brain states, according to whether I'm smelling something which is associated with a reward or a punishment, or whether it doesn't have any meaning? And I will see this with you at the end of the presentation, which is a kind of paradigm shift, if we take a Thomas Kuhn definition, where adult neurogenesis have been always a process suggested to react to the external words, okay? Enrichment from external words produce changes in the adult brain. I'm going to show you, after all, this is a place of Claude Bernard, that the milieu intérieur, the internal states, is also regulating this adult neurogenesis. So we're going to see now this idea that the adult bone neurons are going to integrate both sensory inputs, but also the meaning of these sensory inputs according to the internal states. Now you can sleep. I give you the main point of my presentation. So I'd like to hit three topics with you today. The meaning of adult neurogenesis and the regulation of top-down action, so brain states, regarding learning, memory, and we will see later on reward-associated cues. Later on, we're going to see the unique functions of these other bone neurons. What are they bringing in the pre-existing circuits? You will see very surprising results for us, and these are the results that are now in press. And finally, we will discuss about who is chattering, who is chatting with these adult bone neurons. As I said, many parts of the brain, but also the internal states. That's the reason why I was wondering about immune cells, but Shona is not listening. Okay, so let's go to the first presentation, the first part, the functional meaning of adult neurogenesis regarding olfaction and regarding the content, the sensory content, but also the sensory context in which brain is going to be exposed to. So for that, we have been for many years now using optogenetic. I'm not going to go into detail because all of you are very familiar about that. So I will present data from Antoine Nissan, who is a research assistant at CNRS, and Karine, who has been doing the major injections for all these studies. And what we are doing is injecting either retroviruses, either lentiviruses. We can discuss about the strategy of vectors according to the needs and the question you are asking. And then if you are patient and you wait a few weeks, what you could get is this kind of very lighted olfactory bulb, and all these tiny dots are newborn neurons, at least they have been born when you inject the viruses. And therefore, you can record the functional properties of these newborn neurons. I'm not going into detail about that because this is now about an old story. These adult bone neurons bring intrinsic features, but what is more interesting today is to discuss about their integration to the circuits and what kind of functions are they going to bring into the circuits, not by themselves. Not going to talk about cell autonomous effect, but the integration of adult bone neurons that are now controlled by light. So anytime you can shed light, you know that only the adult bone neurons are going to change the circuits. And for that, we're going to use whole animals, and we're going to record the behavior of this animal when you challenge adult bone neurons. And when I said we, I should say first Mariana, who has been really the pioneer in the lab of combining optogenetic and behavioral analysis. She's not here anymore. She left. She's still there, so you can ask questions. And we're going to see now what kind of impact on the behavior when you decide to stimulate only adult bone neurons. And of course, you can check with optrodes what's going on into the bulb regarding the electrical events. You can also not only shed light and change the behavior, but also you can record the outcome of getting newborn neurons excited. And here, as you can see, for instance, if you record the output neurons of the olfactory bulb, the so-called mitral cells, by shedding lights into these adult bone neurons, you will not be surprised that you get an inhibition, because these newborn neurons mostly are GABAergic ones. So let's go now and investigate the impact of activation of adult bone neurons when animals have to perform a task. Okay, we're going to see the real life now for mice. The task is called a discrimination task. We're going to ask animals to recognize good smell and bad smell. Good ones will be like peppermint, for instance. They smell and they know that they have to get a reward, and they will lick to get a water drop. And in the movie, you will see sometime that the animal is going to smell peppermint and he's not going to get the reward. So this is for us a miss. Now, strawberries, he should not go to drink, but if you go there, then, of course, this is going to be a false alarm. And finally, by smelling strawberries, if you know that you have to refrain drinking, that will be a correct response. Correct rejection. So now we're going to see the real life. We're going to see the animals with this lead implanted here, and we shed light when you have this light over there. So this is now, for instance, peppermint, and he should go drink, and he has been drinking. So he's now 2 out of 6, three out of six. Okay, so we're starting the beginning. This is just to show you what is the setup for that. Animals get some different orders and they should refrain or they should go and drink. What are the results? I should say that not only Mariana have been working on that, but she also have been leading PhD students, Anne Grelal, who is now starting his first year of PhD. And they first started, because we are in France, pastis versus eucalyptus. It's a very easy task. Any French will know where is a pastis and where is a eucalyptus on a table. And so this is a very easy task. And when you submit this task to animals, also, this is for them a very easy task. The black curves here show you the number of trials you have to repeat and the number of correct responses. Animals are learning to discriminate anisole, for instance, associated with a reward, and eucalyptus not going to be associated with a reward. Easy task. It goes very fast. Now we're going to turn the task into a more difficult task, very similar odorants, peppermint versus mint. If you diluted that and if you are a little bit distracted, you could be confused very, very easily. And as a result, if you now looking at the black curves here compared to the black one here, you see, for instance, at 15 trials, animals were pretty good, actually, in knowing who is going to be associated with a reward. But now, I mean, this task is much difficult because at 15, they are barely learning. They are just at the chance level. So you see, the task is much more difficult. What's going on now if you deliver light into the bulb, if you're going to stimulate adult bone neurons? As you can see here, animals are getting now brighter. They learn faster. If you take now 15 trials, for instance, when animals not getting light, difficult, they are just at the chance level. But if they get light, they are already at 80% of correct responses, showing us that these animals are learning. The beauty of these experiments, not really beauty for the animal, but you sacrifice them and you can count the number of newborn neurons, because after all, here are the animals that are getting light, and they are much better than the animals not getting light, because for reaching the criterion of success responses, 85, you get only 12 trials, while the other animal require 25 trials to repeat. So, but within this group of animals that get light, they are good learners and bad learners. So now you can check whether you can find a correlation between the number of newborn neurons and the performance. And this is shown here, where you have the density of newborn neurons, and you can see that there is indeed an inverse correlation. Having a higher density of newborn neurons require less trial to get really good learner. While if you get a lower density, you are in, like, you will need three times trials to get a good learner. So you see there is a perfect correlation with adult bone neurons in between the density of newborn neurons and your performances. I mean, when I said you, I mean mice, of course. I guess you had all in mind that probably this is nothing to do with adult bone neurons. Because after all, by shedding lights, we just engage neurons into the circuit. So maybe there is nothing to do with adult neurogenesis. Maybe any kind of neurons, if you stimulate them by glutamate, acetylcholine, or whatever. We know that attention is this kind of process, recruiting neurons in circuits. So we turn the questions in now injecting channel rhodopsin in a very early born neurons, like P6, wait this animal turn it to be adult, and now stimulate these neurons that have been born at very early stages and see whether we can gain, as we have seen before with adult bone neurons. As you can see here, this is a difficult task. There is nothing to gain when you are stimulating the pre-existing GABAergic interneurons. And interestingly, if you remember, and that was really a tour de force from Mariana, we are dealing here with about, let's say, between 600 and 400, the range of newborn cells per millimeter square, I guess. And here we get, again, we have to adjust the quantity of vectors we introduce into a P6 in order to get at the adult ages, when you have all these pruning events, all this cell dying and whatever, you have to get the same density of neurons, otherwise you cannot compare at all. So as you can appreciate here, the range is about the same. We are ranging between 600 and about 300. So mostly, more or less, we are quite similar to the same density as we have seen with adult motor neurons, but when you shed light here, you don't get any gain. In other words, by stimulating the same population of GABAergic interneurons that were born during either embryogenesis or just few days after birth, you don't improve learning. Okay, so the question that came later on, and this is now work in progress, was whether this light that engage adult bone neurons is specific to the orders associated with a reward, or it could be also that giving light to newborn neurons that were not associated with a reward could be the way you can train animals. So, because I should have said that before, light was delivered either when animals were at any time when animals were smelling odors associated with a reward or odor without association with a reward. So later on, we wanted to know whether these adult bone neurons could be specifically engaged with reward or absence of rewards. And this is shown here. First, if you expose the two odorants, S plus and S minus. S plus meaning odorants associated with the rewards, and S minus, the odorant that is not going to be associated with the reward. And when you exposed first animals without any reward, you check that the density of CFOS staining in adult bone neurons is more or less the same, meaning that the quantity of information into the bulb is more or less the same. Interestingly, if you now start to only expose animals with shedding light only when animals are smelling the S plus, during 4 days, you wait 24 days later, and then you expose the animal to odors S plus, what you can get is an increase of CFOS compared to the newborn neurons that are going to be seen only S minus. So in other words, are newborn neurons able to discriminate and to be engaged differently whether there is a different context? Not content, because the information content is the same, but the context is completely different. Reward, and you have more cells that are reacting, they are hyperactive with the rewards, and when there is absence of rewards, even maybe there is a decrease from one. Again, I told you we've been looking at early born neurons, so if we turn now to look for early born neurons that we are challenging during adult life, first, only exposure without any reward, you get more or less the same, there is no significant differences, and when now only the odorant S plus is associated with the rewards, associated with light, or only when the newborn neurons are receiving light when they are exposed to the odorants without rewards, you don't see any more differences. So you see, that's very important to see now a degree of reactivity of adult born neurons according to the context, and this is only a feature that adult born neurons can fulfill. And the pre-existing neurons, because now they are pre-existing, we're challenging this in the adult life, these pre-existing GABAergic interneurons do not make any discriminations. So now I'm going to show you experiments where we could guess that, okay, let's take newborn neurons, and only when animals are receiving light are they going to change their behavior? Indeed, this is the case. This is a difficult task. The black curves show you animals without getting light. So it's a very, very, very difficult task, you see. More than 20 tries to start understanding the rule. But if you shed light only now on one odorant, the one that is associated with the reward, you improve, as we have seen before, when we were not discriminating S plus and S minus. And if we shed light on the olfactory bulb that is smelling only S minus, you don't get any gain. So you see what we have seen with CIFOS, we can translate it now with this light activation, where we can increase the performance of animals just because newborn neurons receive both sensory inputs and some reward signalings. If we do this with postnatal, early born neurons, again, we don't see any improvement. Here we have the number of trials for control animals. You decrease, so you need only 15 when you need 30 trials. When light is only given to the odorants associated with the reward, and if you get light only on S minus, you don't improve any learning. Of course, I know what you are thinking. Maybe there is some difficulty for learning when you are punished, and it's always better when you get rewards. So now we're going to turn around the questions and going to say, since light does not improve the learning when light is turning on the newborn neurons when they are not associated with a reward, this is S minus. So the S minus, this is a reward. So this is the animals learning with S plus. They are all at 100%. And what now we're going to do? S minus before were receiving light with no reward, was not improving learning. But now we're going to change the rule. S minus is going to be S plus. And we're going to see whether this S minus is now assigned to any bad signals for learning. And in fact, the S minus that turned to be S plus, so this is called the reversal learning. As you can see now, animals are learning faster. So there is no way that S minus is impeding some plasticity, because as soon as you turn now some reward systems into the brain, this S minus, that the odorant that was associated with no reward, is now going to really increase when you are shedding light and engaging these other neurons into this performance task. And of course, if you do the same with early born neurons, again, you are sure that all animals are learning, they are the maximum performance. And again, you're going to change the rules. Are they going to be better if you shed lights? Not, of course, as I told you before, there is no added value by recruiting pre-existing neurons in this kind of task. Okay, so that was the first part of my presentations. In some way, in somehow, adult born neurons are kind of coincident detectors and binding not only the information content, but also the context. Am I getting rewards or am I punished? So let's go now to see the unique functions of these adult born neurons to fulfill this kind of feature I told you before. So this is a paper that was just accepted last week. And at three, I should say, this is a really amazing tour de force in patience, in kind of never giving up. And that was done by Kurt, who have been injecting viruses, make a window, and record every 2 days, which is good because you can stop Friday and start again Monday morning. But the tour de force was not making a break over the weekend, but he was able to record every day or every 2 days the same neurons up to 15 months. If you get a postdoc like that, just tell me, because I think he's unique. I mean, he has something wrong in his brain. You're going to see the results. It's really amazing as he was patient. First of all, he had just the window, cranial window, because, I mean, to be able to track the same neurons over 15 months, you have to be sure that there is nothing wrong into the cranial window, there is nothing inflammatory, and you have to be sure that these windows are going to be clear. So we're going to start here. We go from the top of the bulb, and this is in vivo, in awake animals, head restrained. And the beauty that you're going to correlate what's going on into the bulb, and the animal can lick, can learn, or can be punished, and so on and so far. And you can see when you do this stack, you can reconstruct the neurons in a living animal, awake as well. Okay, so we can go deep into the brain and we can reconstruct those adult bone neurons. We have a specific program for that. We have a mathematician is here. You can ask a lot of questions, doing principal component analysis, machine learning, and other mathematical treatments. We can reconstruct those neurons and, for instance, see them every 2 days growing. That's a beauty, because then you can challenge with any genes, that is your favorite genes involved in any psychiatric disorders or any things that you don't want to have. And you can see how this growing into the living bulb is going to be affected. So the results are shown here, that you can see that there is a growing of the dendritic arborizations. Okay, there is this kind of pruning effect, like during development. So nothing really surprising here. The beauty is that you can track a given neurons every 2 days. You can see that there is a huge diversity. And I put this slide because what we heard from Fiona, of course, it would be nice if we could combine any way to know this cell is born in this place of the subventricular zones and give rise to this kind of feature. These are the rate of growing. And you see there is a huge variability. There are newborn neurons that are really eager to develop, those ones here, and those ones are really not really in a hurry, I would say, a bit lazy. You can make an average and get an estimation. The growing of an adult bone neurons in a living brain is about 12% per day. This is the rate here, 12% every day. And the peak is about 23 days in average. The beauty then later on, you can focus and goes to contact not only the dendritic arborization, because this is important but not relevant for the functional meaning. I remind you that all these tiny dots are boutons, really sites. Okay, so you can see formation of new synapses and you can see other synapses that are going to die. Here comes the quantification. You have within the 24 days, a kind of ratio quite similar, about 30% of stable synapses, new synapses, and lost synapses. And after a given time point, then there is a plateau that is going to be reached around 60% of synapses coming from a newborn neuron that will stay stable. Okay? These are the different time windows here. So you see the maximum is reached around 60% of stable synapses every 2 days. And you have new synapses as well as lost synapses around 20%, as you can see here, over 2 days. Again, the question is, are we looking at a very too narrow window? Let's be patient, and I mean when I mean let's be Kurt has been patient, and as I told you, he went to up to 14 months. And the beauty was, okay, within a few months, there is this number of spines that are going to turn into stable spines, but then they stay as a plateau. And that's for us the major differences. That if you count this percentage of stable synapses, you get 60%. If you do the same experiment, and I will show you the data later on, for the cortex, you get, as you know, about 98%. There are about 2% of dynamic in the cortex. So now I show you the data, the real data. In greens are the synapses that are going to be formed and disappeared. The yellow ones here are the stable ones. This is over. This is a short frames. And this is pictures that taken every 10 minutes. We can take 10 pictures every 10 minutes on 18 months old bone neurons, and you can see. I mean, this. They are. I mean, you know that the lifespan of mice is about 2 years. So we are here dealing with a very old. Postnatal neurons, and they are really still very active. So there is something unique in this, intrinsically into these neurons. I mean, look how they are really active and eager to contact a synaptic partner. If we go now to the cortex, it's boring. I mean, you can't barely see anything moving. Of course, I should say, what you have been looking at before were a GABAergic interneurons, while here we are looking pyramidal cells. That's very important to mention. Okay, so when we look and make a summary at very different time points, you have like a stable value, which is about at any time point, within 2 months after birth, 3 months, 4 months, you don't change. This seems to be a kind of intrinsic features. The percentage of newborn synapses or lost synapses will remain constant, about 20% every 2 days. Now, there is something probably that is jumping in your mind. I'm talking about formation of presynaptic GABA release. And you have seen they are really highly dynamic. Are these new formed synapses are going to hijack pre-existing postsynaptic GABAergic synapses, or because they are moving, they will induce also a dynamic in the postsynaptic partners? This is a very important question, because for many, many years, the postsynaptic partners eat the mitral cells, and these cells are known to be stable. But depending on what you are looking at. If you're looking at the spine, they are not spine, but the dendritic arborizations and the structural plasticity of these mitral cells, there is no plasticity. So we were guessing that having these synapses moving around every 2 days, you change 20% of synapses. We were thinking that maybe the new form synapses are just hijacking a new synapses, or alternatively, they will trigger the formation of new synapses. And this was done by Matt Vallée, who has been looking at postsynaptic sites. And these are the GAFRIN puncta, so this means the GABAergic receptors. And nicely, what you can see, there are new synapses. So I'm talking about the postsynaptic receptors are very highly dynamic. You have the blue ones are the stable ones, the pinker are the new ones, and you're going to see one that will disappear. Okay? So again, we are facing, on the postsynaptic sides, quite similar dynamic. And the beauty came when we count the turnover, the dynamic. Now we are going to make, so these experiments were done simultaneously, the presynaptic site with the dendrites and the spine of the newborn neurons growing and moving, and looking at the postsynaptic receptors, the trafficking, are they going to move? And if you do this every day, you find the same ratio. That, for us, was really amazing, because that means you have a presynaptic and postsynaptic mechanism that make, for some reason, maybe some transsynaptic proteins, make this process a concerted process. Anytime you bring a new terminals, you also bring a new receptors, because you have seen here that we are every day a ratio of about 10% of new synapses form or 10% of new synapses lost. Okay, I hope I'm not losing you. Still awake? We're jumping now to the third part of the presentation. Who is talking to these newborn neurons? to trigger this plasticity, to trigger the meaning of the context in which you are exposed. For that, as many of us are doing, we are injecting vectors in different parts of the brain, and we have been looking at the downstream structure of the olfactory bulb. So olfactory bulb sent sensory information to the cortex, and when you load this pyramidal cells, you see a kind of feedback re-entry. I mean, Edelman liked to call the re-entry loop. So the cortex is sending back now information to the bulb. Who are the targets of these cortical top-down fibers? When you inject this M-cherry into the cortex, as you can see here, and at the higher magnification, mostly the target of these top-down fibers goes to the granule cells, the GABAergic interneurons of your olfactory bulb. And when you look carefully, you have different layers, you see that these cortical fibers goes mostly in what we could call the proximal synapses to a newborn neurons. And when we did a trick where we were looking at the intrinsic circuitry within the bulb, loading mitral cells with these GFP markers, you can see that this intrinsic circuitry connect adult bone neurons mostly distally, at the distal regions. So now what we're going to see, whether an odorant is going to be associated with a reward, are we going to change circuits here or here? Yeah, okay, they are making synapses, I'm jumping. And here is the results. This is air exposure. This is a passive exposure of odorants. And now this is the odorant that is going to be associated with a reward, as you can see here. So we have three different groups of animals, and what you can observe is only when animals are learning, they are not passively exposed, but they are learning a rule and they are associating odorants with rewards, you have an increase of synaptic contacts. And where do you find this synaptic contact increase? Here, where you get the cortical inputs. Not going into details, but just to tell you that these structural changes are also leading to functional changes, because not only you get more synapses coming from the cortex, in density it's increased, but also the synaptic strength is also higher. Okay, I'm going to accelerate a little bit. When you inject vectors to load the newborn neurons, as I showed you since the beginning, with red staining to look at the structural plasticity, what you could do as well, if you are using Krebs mices, that you can inject GCAM to load the cell with a proxy for calcium activity. And then you can combine structural changes with functional changes and see what's happened if newborn neurons receive odorants with rewards in terms of calcium signaling. Okay, let's move on. You are familiar. So here are the situation. The animal is very happy and he's get a reward here. He's smelling and we are looking in his brain. Okay, and now we're going to look. This is again work in progress. Okay, the calcium signaling into the brain. For you, there is no really meaning, but I must tell you this kind of improving the quality of analysis came from the mathematical process from SOAM. And nicely here, we can see now really newborn neurons reacting to odors with calcium transients. And the beauty is that when you expose an animal before rewarding odors, you don't get from newborn neurons, you don't get calcium responses. But after doing some training and associating odors with rewards, with S+, you get a nice calcium responses. You have changed the receptor field. These cells that we are not really paying attention to odors now are highly responsive to these odors. And nicely, if you look at odors that have not been associated with rewards, not only you don't get this increase, but there is a kind of inhibition that is now work in progress. We need to understand whether it's more important actually to get an inhibition of calcium that should appear and you don't get this inhibition, or whether this is a meaning that there is an increase of calcium transients. Okay, so these are the first part of my third part, which is cortical fibers goes into the bulb and bring in some way a reward value, and newborn neurons are able to integrate. But in the past experiments that we have been doing, we were looking also whether adult neurogenesis could be challenged with different situations. And I'm not going really into details, but we have been looking at the impact of corticosteroid treatment for many weeks, 8 weeks precisely, and look and combine whether we could see changes in adult neurogenesis with odorant detection here. This is a perception, and this is a memory. And then we wanted to do also some tests for the hippocampus. I must say this was done with Denis David, Alain Gardier, and Jean-Philippe Guillou. Without them, we would have not been able to really develop this panel of behavioral explorations for the animals. And I'm not going into detail, but you have seen this many times from René and Denis David and teams and so on and so far. So you can really combine change of the degree of adult neurogenesis with some behavioral changes with more anxiety and depression. This is just to keep you now awake and updated with ongoing work. We started to wonder, there is maybe something that is coming from the brain and acting on this adult neurogenesis. But the way we thought were to look as a kind of holistic approaches, looking everywhere in the body. So when, after all, you know, either you do this unpredicted chronic mass stress or you treat animals with corticosterone. Corticosterone does a lot of things. As you know, the immune responses are inhibited and so on and so forth. So we started to wonder whether maybe by corticosterone treatment, we could change the microbiota composition in the gut. This is called dysbiosis. And here is the result. So I'm talking about that. Thanks God it's not lunchtime. This is a feces analysis. We're looking at the bacteria composition in the feces. And these are the control animals. When green, low composition. And after corticosterone treatments, you turn in red. That means you have multiplied by 2, by 3, as you can see here, for instance. For this family, the Firmicutes, they are here. There is a kind of twofold increase. So some bacteria, after corticosterone treatments, because you challenge, either because corticosterone does something directly to the flora, and we don't know yet, or because you are challenging also the immune responses in the gut, in some way, you change the composition of bacteria. You increase a family here, shown, from green to red, and you decrease from red to green, another family. And I will show you these are the good guys and that the bad guys. I should say, again, this was done in collaboration with Grégoire Chevalier, who is working in the Department of Immunology at the Pasteur Institute and with Eleni Siopi. So after corticosterone treatments, you get an increase of some bacteria shown here. Now we're going to bet that if we take a healthy mice, use corticosterone treatments, make this mice depressed, as I show you with this genetic analysis, we can change the flora. The idea was let's make this microbiota transplantations. In other words, you take feces and you put this in a bottle of water and wait 8 weeks. And let's look now how this animal that was very healthy, is now behave. First of all, we check what's going on in the gut. Control, these are these bacteroides, the good guys and the bad guys. When you treat with corticosteroids, you increase this firmicutes and you decrease the bacteroides. Now we're going to do this transplantation, either from healthy animals that we are not treated with corticosterone, and barely we don't change the ratio. We are dealing with germ-free animals here after this transplantation. So at least what was dominant is still dominant. But now look what's happened with the animal receiving the feces from depressed animals. You change this ratio. And when I mean you change this ratio, you change as well the behavior. Here are the animals now that have been treated with microbiota from the depressed animals. They were healthy, like those ones, and now they express the hallmark of anxiety or depression. Okay, so that's my last slide. We are now digging into understanding what kind of signals these bacteria are sending, either in the survival, as you can see here. These are the normal mice that you all have in your animal facility, and germ-free. When you look for this survival, in germ-free animals, newborn neurons does not survive as much as they should survive. But if you are looking at proliferation, you get the opposite. Proliferation is accelerated when you remove germs into the gut. And this is standing for the hippocampus, and this is true as well for the either subventricular zones or the olfactory bulb. So I'd like to conclude with this slide. We have seen that adult bone neurons facilitate discrimination. They are useful when the task is difficult. Nothing to gain from adult bone neurons when it's an easy task. We have seen that these functions is expressed and is controlled by these top-down fibers. And finally, I just put this work in progress, where not only top-down brain states is controlling the function of adult bone neurons, but the whole internal states. And I mean, we just put our fingers on bacteria, but maybe this is a more complex system through microglia, from microphages, goes not what. Finally, I should thank the people who have been doing the job, Kurt and Matt, who have been looking at this dynamic pre and post concerted mechanisms, Mariana, who have been with Anne working on this reward associated cues on adult bone neurons, Gabriel, who is recording in vivo with electrophysiological recording the function of these adult bone neurons. I didn't went into really details about that. Antoine recording cells in slices. As Eleni with the depression work. As I said, this was part of the work, especially on depression and mood disorders, was really done thanks to this great collaboration we have with Alain Gardier Labs, Gérard Rebels for the microbiota, and Hong Jung Song, because actually Kurt Seller was a PhD student in Hong Jung Song, and he started this work on growing dendrites into the olfactory bulb. Thank you very much. Just I would like to start to finish with a quiz. This is a coronal section of the olfactory bulb, but this is also looking to a painting. Which one? The screen. Okay, thank you very much for your attention.